Welcome to the Joy of Healthcare podcast, where we discuss how you can make a difference and put people at the center of everything that you do. I'm your host, Jessie Israel. I'm a nurse, a population health leader, and an all-around healthcare nerd. I am not even sure where to begin in introducing my good friend and colleague, Jody Smith. Jody is one of Kaiser Permanente's greatest and brightest. She oversees the hospital and post-acute care operations. She was Eric Coleman's research assistant. He's the national leader in care transitions while she was completing her nurse practitioner. She is somebody who I think is a true thought leader and one of my most favorite people in healthcare. Today, what we're going to talk about is what kind of support people need when they are leaving the hospital. What does value-based care even mean? And specifically, what does it mean for patients and, in her case, members? And how connecting with people is really the foundation for all of healthcare reform. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the episode. Today I have with me Jody Smith. Jody is the Regional Administrator of Hospital Operations and the Post-Acute Care Network for Kaiser Permanente. Thanks for joining me, Jody.
Thanks so much for having me.
And today is a pretty special episode. Jody is my friend and colleague, and this is the first time that we are trying out having a little bit of wine here to discuss healthcare. So consider this our Tim Ferriss and Kevin Rose episode. And with that, I just want to have Jody go over the difference between Kaiser and Permanente. So we're going to start off with something easy. I've worked with Kaiser for many years, and it really took me until the last maybe 2 or 3 years to fully appreciate the difference between the two. So can we start there, Jody?
Yeah, so Kaiser Permanente is both a health plan, so an insurance side, the insurance function of our business, and then the Permanente, which is CPMG, which is our physician group, is the provider side of the business. And together, the value of that and the power of that is an integrated delivery system.
What does CPMG stand for those who don't know?
Colorado Permanente Medical Group.
Okay. Great. So it's fair to say that one is the insurance company and the others are the providers.
Yes. And I'm on the health plan side of the business.
But you're also a provider.
So yes. Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah. So the health plan's full of nurses and business people and doctors and IT folks. And so the health plan consists of many, many different roles and people, all good people wanting to do great work and want to work for the mission that is Kaiser.
So is it fair to say that the health plan is the side that pays the bills and the Permanente side is the people who provide the care?
That's very simply and beautifully put.
Okay, yep. Great. So you have seemingly a really amazing job with a level of influence that most people would hope to have. And what advice might you have for somebody wanting to live in Jody's shoes?
You know, I would like to say that I chose this. I had a wonderful family situation when I was little where my grandmother took care of my great-grandmother, and she also took care of me after kindergarten. And so I was always in this intergenerational home. And then when I was in high school, I just took a course and became a certified nurse's assistant. And then I just worked my way through undergrad in college in home care. And that is the first moment where I've got the bug and the passion for the power and the intimacy of being with and of service to people. And I had an experience in my undergrad where I was taking care of this woman, and we'll call her Ruth. And all I did was get her up out of bed every morning. And how I didn't realize at the time, but now looking back on it, that has set the path for me in my career, in wanting to advance my career and wanting to get into geriatrics and chronic care management and chronic disease management and policy. around, sometimes people just need a little help. It's not that she had Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Ruth was very well cared for. It's just that they just needed a little help. And so every job I've ever took, I'm just trying to give people a little help navigating the complexity of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So with your trajectory at Kaiser, would you, you know, talking about advice for somebody else, I guess maybe I'll frame the question of, do you think it's been an advantage for you to stay with the same company over a long period of time? Or do you think there's an advantage to trying out several different things?
That's a great question, because I am somebody who thinks that I have drank the Kool-Aid of the mission of Kaiser Permanente being a nonprofit and an integrated care delivery model where we're both the insurer, but we're also the provider. And so the power of that is really does have the patient at the center. And being here for 17 years, as even though I've drank the Kool-Aid, has been, there's highs and lows, but I'm proud of the care we provide our members. And I didn't choose where I am in the company. I think just showing up, being accountable, being engaged, always having patients and members at the center, having a passion for that, has enabled me to kind of climb the ranks, if you will, within Kaiser. And, you know, and as a nurse and a nurse practitioner, what I struggle with personally is that why I went into nursing is because it served my soul and my heart very selfishly. And now being in leadership, I have to convince myself intellectually. I have to tell my heart that intellectually I'm serving at a bigger level or a higher level, and I can serve more people than the one-on-one nursing care. But that just doesn't serve my heart sometimes. So I have to get that nursing care elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes that can be, for some people, not for me, but for some people, that can be something that you have to work on reconciling, is that that's still the ability to affect one patient versus the ability to affect many patients.
Yeah. It's just serving in a different way.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. So today we wanted to go a little deeper on the ways that we can support our patients. You've developed some pretty amazing programs, and wanted to go through some of those programs that you've developed and unpack the pact.
But people are on a lot of medicines these days. What's your goal blood pressure? And, you know, my only kind of statement about that is people just don't know what they're aiming for or why they're swallowing these pills and what they're trying to do. And so, you know, using the nursing model and using nurse practitioners, we can really dive deep into that and have those discussions. We really ask and request and love when family members can be a part of the visit. We talk through palliative care all the time. Kaiser Permanente in Colorado was the founding father of home-based palliative care and palliative care in our regions, amongst our regions. So we have a lot of discussions in that golden window of opportunity around, like, boy, you were just in the hospital. That's your third hospitalization. Here's your disease state. What's your goals? So we can develop something that's somewhat concordant with what the patient or the member wishes. And it seems so natural in the home. People can hear us, and it's, you see anxiety and you see understanding just wash over people, anxiety reduction and knowledge wash over people. And I've said this before at many conferences, but it's the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my nursing career. To be able, and I love Kaiser for the fact that they invest in us, invest in people to go meet our members where they're at and have this. So selfishly, it's the most rewarding work, but the outcomes of this program feel like not only are we providing excellent care, excellent service, but there's incredible return on investment when you stop people going back to the hospital unavoidably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about medications. You mentioned medication reconciliation, which is a different process than medication adherence. So the first question is really around med rec, as we call it. What kind of things do you find in the home? I think there's maybe an assumption that the general public thinks people know what they should be taking and why, and that that's probably a false assumption. So maybe some of your findings when you're in the home with patients on their medications they think they should be taking.
Yeah, it's probably a comment more globally in America. If we're having troubles with an integrated delivery system, with an electronic medical record that everybody has access to, if we're having troubles with reconciling medications across venues, across transitions, across specialties, I can't imagine what's happening outside, you know, outside of our system. But what I will say is, I've come to realize that MedRec has become a little bit of a hold your nose and check the boxes and something we have to do from a regulatory standpoint. The intent is good, right? I mean, to try and reconcile people's medications before they came in the hospital, while they were in the hospital, and then what's expected of them after they leave the hospital. That's important work and it shouldn't stop. But I think we do it without including the patient. And I think we check the boxes really well, but being in thousands of homes over the years, the output of that work actually isn't sinking in to how the member should manage. And we create a lot of complexity around, I mean, by calling medications by names that nobody can pronounce, to brand versus generic versus different formularies versus, I mean, we've honestly created a system that not even the experts, I'm putting air quotes, in within the system have a hard time piecing out. And so two things. One, if you're a patient and you're injecting, ingesting, you know, taking a medicine, my plea is that you know what it's for, know what you're trying to accomplish, talk to your doctors about it. But it's just so complicated. When I was doing the randomized control trial with Eric Coleman back in the day, patients at that time were taking on average 8 medications. Today, our members are taking, and the high risk population are taking on average 14 medications. So imagine trying to suss that out, right? Around, well, this one's 3 times a day and you must take it with food. This one's twice a day, but it needs to be on an empty stomach. This one's just for this symptom, but this one is to counterbalance that system. I mean, it's actually quite a symptom of how not just Kaiser, but in America, we're treating chronic illness and comorbidity in an acute mindset around not going 5 layers why on why your thyroid's crapping out, or why, you know, you have diabetes, or why you have heart failure, or why, you know, and then really trying to get a comprehensive care plan around that. Because in these people's homes, not only is it not going well, that's why I think PACT has had such exceptional results, is because we're there at the right time, at the right place, meeting members where they're at and talking to them, you know, at their kitchen table in a place where they can hear us around their health and their meds.
Do people know when they leave the hospital what they're supposed to be taking in general?
I'd say half do not.
Half do not. Okay. That's.
And I'm being a little conservative, but 50% sounds so like I have so much chest pain around that, saying that number out loud. But we, our program actually tracks med discrepancies and then the severity of the discrepancy. I mean, if somebody says, take calcium, and we get to the home and they're not on calcium, you know, no harm, no foul, unless they just had a hip fracture. But I'm just to make a point, versus you're taking both metoprolol and atenolol, which for the listeners is the same class of drug. It's just different. And so you don't take those together, but people go home and they resume what they did before they came to the hospital. And now we've added something else and they're taking the same thing and they're taking double, triple the same medication. So everything from no harm, no foul to actually we could be causing harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happens when you don't do a program like this? And I don't think we've said it yet, but PACT stands for?
Thank you. Post-acute care team or post-acute care transitions.
Okay, great. So when we're not doing this, what's happening to the sort of general patient that's maybe high risk and doesn't belong to the supportive group? What kind of cracks? Let me ask again, your face.
The answer is they come back to the hospital and they use a lot of services because they're desperately trying to figure it out. And so we did a really intense study within our membership around trying to figure out at discharge who needed this nurse practitioner and who didn't. Like after I had my baby, I didn't really need a packed nurse practitioner in my home. But my 75-year-old father-in-law may need a nurse practitioner. And so when we did that, we found that we were able to risk stratify the population. We found that the high-risk folks, 1 in 3, 1 in 4, come back to the hospital within 30 days. And so we're kind of focusing on that the ED, the hospital, the clinic is the answer, when really maybe just at the time of need, we approach people differently, have different conversations, and think a little differently about what care transitions means and care delivery means. It's not just hospital and clinic anymore. There's this in-between step. In Europe, they have this thing called mind the gap. You know, when you're getting on the subway, for me, it's mind the gap. Go, be very intentional and conscious in that space in between the hospital and the clinic.
That's funny. I developed a Mind the Gap program also.
Oh, you did?
I did, using that exact same phrase. So what does it look like when somebody falls through the cracks? You know, we use that expression all the time. They fell through the cracks. What does that look like in your membership or with your population?
So, And just so you know, PACT serves kind of the highest risk patients in our membership. And so I would say a gap for them just looks like my team will say this, that they're probably sick of hearing me say this, that I'm constantly saying we're fixing a social problem with a medical solution. I think the medical care Kaiser provides is excellent. But until we meet people where they're at and mind the gap, and my passion is around wrapping around social supports to the medical care we provide, because my if any kind of complaint, that's a strong word, is it's not the medical care we provide, it's that we're just constantly trying to fix a social problem with a medical solution and keep pressing that button over. So the people that are in the gap are using a ton of ED and emergency room and hospital and SNF care and home health care, and really they just might need a navigator or a coordinator or a person. I'm your person in Kaiser. Here's my number. You call me, to help navigate and coordinate the complexity of the systems we've set up. Not just Kaiser. I'm just talking about healthcare in the nation. And I think when people fall through the gaps, it's their needs aren't being met in a way that's concordant with their values, or that is sensitive and flexible enough to the ages and stages of where they are in their life. So we have this saying around, really supporting people at the beginning of their life with perinatal home care and perinatal programs, and then that we really have dignified endings where we really have people's backs when they are on the slippery slope or the trajectory of aging and frailty. Yeah.
Okay. That was good.
Did I answer your question?
You did. I think we got there. and people do fall the cracks, and it's not a failing of any one company or any one health system. It is a failing of the entire system.
I will say though that this is my kind of commercial for America, in that it really, really, really requires family involvement, patient engagement, where it really involves involves that level of having somebody having your back in addition to a really great nurse case manager, or in addition to a social worker.
You're bringing up something really interesting, because I think there's a lot of startups and there's a lot of venture capital money going into technology solutions for healthcare. Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing you say is that so much of this is a human connection. Is that an accurate statement? Or
yeah, I'm smiling really big. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, as pendulums swing and we learn and we iterate, you know, health systems, I think the human connection is vital. And you can always look at what can be automated or what can be, you know, where technology can support. And I always say this around telehealth, I'm a huge supporter of it in the right way. But the thing I always say is it matters who's behind the data, who's behind the technology, who's watching Mrs. Jones' heart rate go up into the 120s, and then what do you do with that information? Or Mr. Smith's blood pressure going down into the tank and you're getting that on some remote feed, you know, what do you do with that? And it's around relationships, it's around connection, it's around that human connection, and I trust you, and I trust you enough to have the conversation with you of something that's very scary for me.
Great. We're gonna pivot just a little bit. It feels like transitions of care have taken some traction, and when we say transitions, I think you and I are both talking about that. You've been in the hospital, something bad has happened, and now you have to transition yourself back into the community. So as that takes hold, it feels like maybe readmissions came first, and now transitions of care are kind of a priority for most folks in healthcare. What's coming next? So what's the next step?
So it's interesting. I'm kind of on this path with my personal journey and in my career right now around that. So I feel like care transitions was so 2000s, yep. You know, and yep. Readmission reduction was so 2000s, and it had a lot of press and PR and illumination, and it's important work. It's the right work. But as things do, I think we got a little myopic and a little narrow in just considering just that transition from hospital to home. What's next for me is actually developing robust coordination, navigation, community supports, social supports, wrapping around social resources around the medical care we provide. And so it's actually, in its simplest form, is called population health management. So how do we manage a finite group of people to not just provide healthcare, but to really implement health, inject health into our membership. And so it's not just around hospital admission reduction or readmission reduction or ED utilization reduction. It's, do we have a care delivery system, or do we have a system in the nation to support people a little differently? Again, that's in tune and accommodates the different ages and stages of our lives. I think bricks and mortar is going to be the dinosaur of healthcare of the 90s and 2000s. I think care and health and social supports are going to fingerling out into communities and schools and parks and
So there's a lot of hype around the move from fee-for-service to value-based care. And there are many, many people who feel like that is hype. And then there are many, many people who feel like that is a foregone conclusion. So I'm curious where you fall in that trajectory.
I'd love to hear more from the people who think it's hype. I wonder if they're on the payer side or the provider side or the consumer side.
Well, I think so. What we're still seeing in the health system is that almost all the payments are still fee-for-service, right? And we've been hearing for 10 years, get ready, get ready, get ready. Value-based is coming. And that, you know, Medicare has big goals around 50% of their payments being alternate payment models by 2018, which they're about to hit. They're at 40-some percent. And then you'll hear things from what we refer to as the BUCAs, which is Blue Cross, United, Cigna, Aetna, that they want to have 70% of their payments in alternate payment models. But most folks are still, at least in this market, which is different across the country, still at about that 20% mark. So it's really driven still by fee-for-service or getting paid for sick care. Yet we're still using the "we need to get ready" tool, and we've been using that for a long, long time. Is it actually coming?
Yeah, and I would ask ourselves how it's working for us, right? The fee-for-service model, and is that a sustainable model? And, you know, it's a rhetorical question because I believe that we're not, I believe that healthcare is not in a sustainable model. We all know the statistics around, you know, highest percent of GDP goes to healthcare versus the outcomes. And so I've spent my career kind of from a lion's stance, focusing on the lag metrics. What is the outcome of the work you're doing? Because I think there's a lot of great work going on. There's a lot of well-intentioned people. There's a lot of, but some of it's a little self-serving. Some of it's checking boxes. Some of it's, you know, whatever it is, or it's self-serving through the lens in which you are, right? So hospitals have their lens, health plans have their lens, home care agencies have their lens, skilled nursing facilities have their lens. And until we can look at the way our members trajectory of their journey through their health journey, to use that word again, and until we look at the episode of how people navigate not only the system, but their health and illness, I don't think fee-for-service is serving that well. And I'm very passionate currently around value-based care, that I know my hospital partners have extreme interest in providing the best, highest quality care for members. And what I love about that is we share that member at that moment. Like, they want to provide great hospital care. I want them to get the best quality care. And then I want, you know, I want them to feel confident handing them back off into the Kaiser system. There's limitations to that partnership in a fee-for-service relationship. And so I think value-based is not only the wave of the future, but to have upside and downside risk around the lag outcomes of what we're all trying to achieve in America, I think is not only important, but pretty vital.
And can you just expand on what is upside and downside risk?
Oh, yeah. So if I'm a hospital and you're a health plan, Jesse, and we want to manage heart failure, and we have some national benchmarks that we're saying this is how much they should utilize the hospital, you know, this is how much we think they should have a readmission rate of, and this is how many kind of hospital acquired conditions we should have, that we would share in the management of that population around heart failure. And if we do better than the benchmarks, we share the gains. And if we don't knock it out of the park and we don't hit our goals or benchmarks, then we split the risk, the downside risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Thanks for expanding on that.
Yeah.
So moving further into that, and I imagine that you have access to this data, where do you see areas of inefficient spending?
So, you know, using my previous example, when a program, a fairly simple program, can reduce readmissions by 50%, I think up until that point, that was a pretty inefficient use of dollars. If it's avoidable and you can care for it in a different way that's high quality at a lower cost, that shows me some inefficiencies. I use the example often of when I was 17, I had ACL surgery. And I was in the hospital a week, and I had my ACL redone 30 years later, fast forward 30 years, and I was in the hospital for 6 hours. And so I think as surgical technique improves, I think as, you know, the way we understand pain and healing improves, you know, when I was in the hospital a week, that was probably an inefficient use of dollars. I see a lot of things happening because we're checking boxes versus really diving deep and going towards the patient and asking, do you want to go to a skilled nursing facility? Or I'm thinking of sending you home with physical therapy, but the way it is in the electronic medical record is it's just you order PT and OT, but they might not need OT. So that's one example. That's another example. You know, I was outside a clinic recently and I ran into a woman who was, as I went in, she was sitting by the front door in her wheelchair and I went into a meeting and I came out an hour later and she was still sitting there by the door. And I asked her, I said, can I help you? And, you know, are you okay? What? And she said she was just waiting for her ride through public transportation. And, my first thought, and I don't know if this is good or bad, this might be telling, was I hope this visit was worth it. Because it was so onerous for you to get here and really hard for you to get here and you're still waiting, you know. I didn't say that to her, but I was really thinking like, boy, I hope we knocked it out of the park for you because this was, you were dedicated to get here and to get home. You know, so I feel like the pendulum is swinging from automation and checking boxes to a little more intention, focus, and really kind of my hope is that we're going towards patients and asking them.
Mm-hmm. What about things like, you mentioned this earlier, and these are also hot topics, but what about things like palliative care and behavioral health, where it feels like maybe we're underspending? How do you think we can move from, maybe it's a taboo, maybe that's the reason why we're underspending, to a place where we can really support these kinds of patients?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think nationally that's true. And I think I would say that, again, drinking the Kool-Aid, I'm very proud of Kaiser and the incredible investments in palliative care and behavioral health spaces in the last several years. I would say that this is an area a little where culture eats strategy for breakfast around, are we really robustly, meaningfully, and unapologetically and unabashedly injecting behavioral health and palliative care into kind of primary care? That it's not separate in the corner of organizations or institutions or health plans, that it's really, really robustly just a part of the team. Because I always said this to my patients, where your mental health and your physical health are like conjoined twins, where when we do something to your physical health, that affects your mental health. And when you have something going on with your behavioral health or your mental health, that affects your physical health. And it's very short-sighted to just focus on the physical health of our members. And so we've done a great, great job at really kind of investing and amping up and our behavioral health services we can offer. The next stage of that is really robustly embedding behavioral health into just primary care practice, where it's not a referral and then you have to make an appointment and you can get in 3 weeks, where it's like if a physician's in the exam room with you and you're really struggling dealing with a new diagnosis or just what this illness means to you or whatever, we've got your back.
Yeah. Thanks for that was a great answer. Thanks for that. I just have a couple more questions for you, Jody. And this one's kind of loaded. How can we be better? How can healthcare be better? What's kind of the forefront of your brain on how we can be better today? And I'm actually going to answer this question first before turning it over to Jody because she's making eyebrows at me. So I really think that we could be better in a couple of different ways. The first way is by not assuming that technology can solve all of our answers. And back to our discussion around human connection, I really think that healthcare can be better by asking different questions. It doesn't have to be asking more questions. It doesn't even have to be taking more time. It just is being thoughtful about putting yourself in that other person's place and saying, what would I be confused about? What would I want to do here? How would I get to the next step? And I think we lose some of that in all of the technology and platforms and solutions and vendors and all of those things. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to use that as my forefront of how we can be better. What about you?
So I just listened to yesterday a webinar from Vanderbilt, and it was the New England Journal of Medicine Catalyst series. And the founder of Health Leads, which is a social kind of community resource guide locator, she said this amazing thing, and it actually brought me to tears, and probably is trying to illustrate the point I'm trying to make around how we could be better. So there was a young man who came into the hospital, and he was thin and losing weight and losing weight and losing weight and losing. And, you know, as we do in the systems we create, they ran panels and, you know, da da da. And at the end, did tests and ran bloods and, you know, did all sorts of things. And in the middle of that, there was one person who, in the middle of all this, like trying to figure out the question mark of this young man around why he's losing all this weight, somebody said, well, maybe he's hungry. And so to answer your question, how I think we can get better is we have to run and not walk into not only asking better questions, but leave our bricks and mortar and go out into the community and talk to people, be unabashedly curious about them and what their experience is, and I think that is the next evolution of healthcare is going deep into our communities and helping them help us to help them to help us is what I always say and how I think we could be better.
Mm-hmm. That's a great story. This is next question, and almost my final question is one of my favorites. So if Jody Smith were to start her own company, what would that look like? And it can be in or outside of healthcare.
So my dream and my kind of next stage in retirement, I've been planning a nonprofit. So in my community, there's a nonprofit for little babies dealing with critical and catastrophic and terminal illness. And they've got that corner, and babies scare me. I love older people and geriatrics. And so I would start a nonprofit in my community that is, you had a podcast about it actually around a company, and it was called A Little Help. And before I even heard, I was so inspired by that. I'm actually going to reach out to him. But for me, I just want to go sit in, selfishly, I just want to go sit in people's living rooms and like take out their trash and feed their cat and drive them to a Pilates class. And I want to just be a little help to round out the corners of their lives.
Great. This has been really great. I think I have gotten goosebumps like 4 or 5 times during our conversation. So it's been really powerful and really fun. Jody, if people want to find you, I know you do a lot of speaking, especially around PACT, the post-acute care transitions. How would they find you in the world?
They can email me, and I'll just spell that out. My name's Jody with an I, jodi.d.smith@kp.org.
So is your middle name David?
No.
Okay. We're going to leave it there. Thanks, Jody.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you so much for sticking with Jody and I today. As we connected, there were several moments where I was sipping my wine, actually getting goosebumps from her insights. I hope that she left you feeling inspired and like you wanted to do the right thing for the right reasons in what you do each day. As always, we would love to hear from you. Seriously, I am talking to you. How do you think that we can do better in healthcare? Come and find me and let me know. I'm at www.joyofhealthcare.com. And of course, I'm always pushing the ratings on iTunes because I'm waiting for my magical iTunes number so I can show up in the star ratings. So go on there and give me positive, negative, whatever you have. Thanks so much for listening.